Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me to this symposium, which really touches upon a very, very important aspect. What do we do with architects' houses? Before my excursions into the question, what characterizes and distinguishes the building by Ludwig Wittgenstein, a few thoughts on creativity. Wittgenstein's building was constructed at the peak of classical modernism. The Bauhaus complex in Dessau by Walter Gropius, the Villa Savoie by Le Corbusier, the Tugendhat House by Mies van der Rohe, and the Maison de Verre by Pierre Charot were all built between 1925 and 1931. To put it simply, how did modernist architect approach the design of new architecture? Innovative ideas regarding space played an important role, maybe the idea of interlocking heights by Adolf Loos, or open dynamic concepts of space, the ethics of new technology, new materials, light, health, visionary, social and political concepts were among the parameters of new architecture, combined with a disregard, almost a rejection of history and tradition in architecture. These few considerations seem very appropriate before analyzing Wittgenstein's architecture, because we know that his way of thinking and working was not in keeping with that of modernism. He had a disregard for modern architecture. The reasons for the aesthetic appearance of his building, which is astonishingly consistent and aesthetically coherent in every way, lies in this fundamental difference. Now, how did Wittgenstein think architecture? Before trying to answer this question through analyzing some aspects of his work, I would like to reflect briefly on another question. The question as to what evoked Wittgenstein's interest in architecture. After having finished the Tractatus, he thought he had solved all the problems of philosophy, and he became a country school teacher in three small villages in Lower Austria between 1921 and 1925. His biographies frequently tell us in a few words that Wittgenstein built a house for his sister Margaret between 1926 and 1928. But why should Wittgenstein build a house for his sister? A residential house. And that, together with Paul Engelmann, a pupil of Adolf Loos, who was quite obviously interested in realizing and further development his Loosian ideas of architecture. Margaret Stoneborough commissioned none of the well-known and experienced architects in Vienna. There were quite a few first-rate architects working in Vienna at that time. She instead asked Paul Engelmann, a friend of Ludwig's and a friend of the family Wittgenstein, who was for the first time in his life faced with the task of designing a large city villa. Undoubtedly, she made this choice because she wanted to be involved in the design process herself. At that period in their lives, brother and sister, Ludwig and Margaret, understood and respected each other very much. They were very close. Wittgenstein's interest, however, did not lie in this project because he wanted to find the fitting architectural frame for his sister's way of living. And he was certainly not interested in architecture as a material expression of the culturally correct way of living, of a new style of life, of demonstrating the good taste of true modern man. Wittgenstein wanted to face new challenges. The challenge in and around the field of architectural thinking and about building as a fundamental confrontation with himself. The house on Kontmanngasse in Vienna bears witness of how intensely, to the point of collapse at times, as he writes in a letter, Wittgenstein must have worked on it. Working on architecture, building a house, after all, was in itself a new challenge, an exploration of the self, reaching out far beyond the mind into the physicality of scale, material, color, eye, proportion, the gesture of grasping and striding. This evidently means that Wittgenstein did not build the house for his sister, he built it for himself. And Wittgenstein claimed it his house, but of course not to live in it. One quote from a letter to his friend Keynes in England. My dear Keynes, I have taken up architecture. I'm in the process of building a house in Vienna. This is causing me considerable worry, and I'm not even certain that I won't patch it up. Second letter. Dear Keynes, I have just finished my house, which has occupied me entirely over the past 2 years. I enclose a few photos and hope that you don't find its simplicity too offensive. As ever, yours, Ludwig. In the early 30s, Wittgenstein began pasting photographs in a small pocket album. These are photographs of his family, friends, landscapes and places and occasions. In a purely pictorial language, he mounted a multi-layered image of his milieu, without text, without dates, no notations, captions, or page numbers, and without a clear temporal sequence. In this album, which he always carried with him, Wittgenstein pasted 8 photographs of the house he had built. On this page, you see on top Margaret Stoneborough, the client, and on the bottom, Ludwig Wittgenstein. And this is one of the photographs he pasted in his pocket album, the entrance hall. And this is a photograph from the outside, taken in 1928. Another photograph from 1928, Wittgenstein behind the flowers, slightly asleep in the center of the photograph. Margaret asked Paul Engelmann to design a mansion for her in Vienna, and she had very strong ideas and she knew what she wanted. We know that Wittgenstein was involved from the beginning and that he understood his sister's intentions better than Engelmann, giving good ideas, as Engelmann put it himself. Wittgenstein joined the office at the end of May, the beginning of June 1926, and this first plan I'm showing you is from the end of May 1926. It is evident that Ludwig did not execute somebody else's plans and that he shaped, after he joined the office, the architecture in his way of thinking and working. Referring to his own thinking, Wittgenstein said, and I think this is important, I think I have never invented a movement of thought. Rather, it was always given to me by someone else, and I have then, with great passion, immediately incorporated it into my endeavor to clarify thought in this way. In this way, Boltzmann, Hertz, Schopenhauer, Russell, Krauss, Loos, Weininger, Sprengler influenced me. Wittgenstein had, through working on and in architecture, deepened his cognitive capacity. Above all, he gained aesthetic knowledge. The motif of a central hall, which you see in this plan, which one gains access, from which one gains access to the representative rooms, has its roots in the tradition of Viennese palace architecture. In the planning of Margaret Stoneborough's mansion, the hall represents more than in an intention to link the Palais Stoneborough to this Viennese tradition. Margaret was just as familiar with this type of building as her brother, because it refers to the central hall with a single flight staircase in their parents' palais in Vienna. This idea, which can only have come from Margaret and Ludwig, lends the building its so-called family resemblance. It was Wittgenstein's approach to adopt ideas and forms as stimuli and to then purify and clarify them. The sketch plan you see from May 18, 1926 has a main architectural idea that speaks a clear language, a central hall with adjoining music, dining and breakfast rooms. This part complies with the intentions of the client and her aspirations. This part also is worked out thoroughly, and the access, rhythm and connections are all clearly drawn. Obviously, this is where Margaret and Ludwig made their contribution. The other rooms surrounding the central hall reveal a very different spirit. They may well have been designed from outside as elements in the composition of the building block, but as interiors, they are not fully thought out, nor are they drawn with the same conviction. Stairs, niches, walls of shelving in a passageway flanked with columns have the scale of intimate rooms in a comfortable bourgeois apartment. They are related to the spirit of Adolf Loos. For Loos, a house must be first of all comfortable. But Margaret obviously was not inclined to have a comfortable house in the spirit of Loos. The working drawings. This is a picture of the entrance hall, the vestibule to the parents' palais in Vienna. Stairs going up one flight. And this, because I mentioned the history of the tradition of palace architecture, is the Palais Razumovsky in Vienna from 1807, right? And you see in the center the vestibule, which has some similarity to the Wittgenstein ideas. The working drawings now, dated November 15th, 1920. Six, which is just a few months later, form a densely woven mesh of spaces by making significant alterations to the proportions, by expanding the layout and by making two deciphered additions, the spatial sequence entrance, vestibule, hall and the staircase. This architecture is, despite its asymmetry, a kind of absolute complete formation that is solidly and complexly put together and in which nothing can be changed, and indeed nothing was changed. It is completely in Wittgenstein's spirit and by his hand. Everything in the sketch plan from May 18, 1926, which was reminiscent of Loos' ideas on dwelling, was eliminated. The entrance forms now an almost ritualistic sequence of spaces, a gesture. A gesture that clearly reveals the character of the house. The hall with its central staircase may well have been inspired by the Wittgenstein family palais, as I said, but this is not at all a formal stylistic variation. It is of a different quality. It is radically new in its spatial composition, in its sense of space, and in terms of spatial effect. This is the essence of Wittgenstein's extraordinary achievement. The hall on top has a width of 6 meters and 85 centimeters, between the terrace and the wall plane to the salon. But it is only 6.5 meters long. Yet it is extended visually by two tow beams projecting a few centimeters below the plane of the ceiling to create a space that appears to have sides of equal length. Again, this is the entrance. This is what I call this ritualistic approach to the house. And this is a plan of the hall. And here you see on top on the ceiling these two beams suggesting a certain direction and at the same time giving the space this kind of feeling of a square space. That means length and width have a one-to-one relationship, but not in a geometric sense, nor in terms of technical scale, but rather as an aesthetic effect. This results from a complex weave of interlocking elements, parts, indicated directions, and references between dimensions. On both ends of the glass wall to the terrace, a quarter capital sits on a quarter pier, right, which itself forms part of the pilaster that lies between the hall and the outside. The beam that runs above the large area of glazing rests, in a structural sense, upon this pilaster. This beam has the same height as the somewhat reduced quarter capital, so in these two corners, quarter column, pilaster, internal and external architecture, quarter capital and beam flow into each other, an architectural joint with a number of meanings. The impression of Wittgenstein's architecture is significantly defined by the fact that he reduces So, another view of the hall, and this is the so-called Wittgenstein capital, which of course is not a capital, but it is clear that what he wanted, this kind of tight joint, which has different meanings, can only be achieved with a capital which is recessed, as opposed to the classical capital. Reduction in Wittgenstein's case is not simplification. It is more than anything else condensation. Condensation that one can feel, not just read. For instance, only dense material is used. Artificial stone slabs for the flooring and hard stone render on the walls of the hall. Transitions play a very important and significant role in this architecture. The connections between hall and living room library consist of two pairs of transparent glass doors, as opposed to the other end of the hall, one leading to the staircase and one leading to the dining room, where you have one pair of glass transparent and the other one translucent. This combination allows different ways of making translucent and transparent spatial connections between the hall and the dining room and between the hall and the staircase. There is a direct visual connection when the transparent doors are closed and the translucent doors are open. When closed, the translucent doors separate inside from outside without sealing the interior hermetically as a metal door would do. It is only the use of these tall, slender double doors that allows the development of a temporary aesthetic image, a symbol, a series of architectural gestures that make the connections between the spaces both visible and tangible as one moves around the house. The inner pair of leaves of each set of double doors opens into the hall, whereas the other pair opens, in each case, into an adjoining space. These are two gestures pointing in opposite directions, leaving a space and entering a space. If both pairs of double doors are completely open, a temporary architecture of transition, a kind of processional architecture, is created. This is the emphasis, indeed, almost a celebration of a short route in which the temporal sequence of leaving and entering is abolished. The connections, the join, becomes an architectural symbol depicting the time of transition and extending the line separating two spaces into the direction of both. When the two pairs of doors are closed, this transitional space is folded back into the wall. The most unusual transition is the pair of double doors between the salon and the sitting bedroom of Margaret Stoneborough. By virtue of their materiality, there are a very rare connections between open glass and closed metal. When in use, this pair of double doors offers numerous variants of Margaret for Margaret Stoneborough to separate or to include her private living in the rest of the building. When the metal leaves are closed, full acoustic and visual separation is achieved. When the metal doors are open, when the metal doors are open and the glass doors are closed, the salon is visually integrated in the more intimate area, but acoustically separated. A single closed metal leaf signifies something quite different. An open single glass leaf is like an open approach, whereas when both doors are wide open, salon and sitting room merge. The salon is the most harmonious space in the Wittgenstein house. Its dignity is reflected in its strict symmetric order. The surface of the opposite wall, which relates actually to the metal door, is articulated by three identical wall openings. As a result, it is read as a single wall, although it is actually both an external wall, two window doors, and an internal wall, full metal door leading to the sitting room, bedroom of Margaret Stoneborough. So it can be represented in the numbers 2 to 1. Read as a surface with the wall, then it is symmetrical, defined by the number 3. The openings of the wall on the long axis of the space amount to the number of 3, 2, 1. The length of the room measures 930 centimeters. The height of the metal door is 310 centimeters. The proportion is 3 to 1, but this time interconnecting in a horizontal and a vertical plane. Another important aspect of the building is how Wittgenstein defines the transition of inside and outside. This is the original state of the living room. As you can see here on the right side, the three openings. On the left side, there's one single door leading to the hall. And you see the proportions 930 to 3-1 or 3 openings to 1. And this is unfortunately the situation we have it today. The main and I think the most important wall of the house has been destroyed in order to create room for a concert or other cultural activities. The house was placed in a park That's why it's important how Wittgenstein treats the transition from inside to the outside. The two terraces are essential elements in Wittgenstein's overall architectural concept. One is adjacent to the hall and the dining room, and the other to the salon and the sitting room. They inspire Wittgenstein to reflect on the tradition between inside and outside. Wittgenstein's building, situated in the middle of an old park, as I said, the separation between inside and outside remains clear. This was at a time when modern architects thought to link inside and outside by means of large glazed walls. Mies van der Rohe used the largest glass pane available as an expression of his time. When open, the double window doors strongly accentuate the transition between inside and outside, instead of blurring it. Just as the double doors, when open, become temporary spaces again of transition. A transitional zone, a boundary layer, an intermediate space is created, which is both inside and outside. The transition itself is made material. Wittgenstein thinks through the movement of transition and gives it form. Again, a reduced, minimalist, condensed form. The hidden catch that holds the inner and the outer door leaves together when open is one of the most brilliant inventions in his architectural work. He did not wish to use hooks, locks, or other forms of fastening to fix these doors. He designed a metal beak fixed to the lower frame of the inner leaf and a runner at the same time at the same position on the opposite leaf. The outer leaf, in order to hold the two heavy doors, leaves together. This beak is a cast metal element. A spring plate with a small calotte is screwed into it from below. On the underside of the runner, opposite, there are six shallow depressions. That means when the beak locks into the runner, thereby fixing the doors in one of the six possible positions. The various positions of the double doors are like symbols of different connections, different transitions between inside and outside. Wittgenstein plays with variations of giving the space a meaning of forming the wall. He folds the wall surface to create a glass screen with narrow ventilation slots and modifies it to create, when all the doors are open, a layer of boundary space that is both inside and outside. In order to close up the sharply defined wall openings containing the window doors in the evening, Wittgenstein invented a solution that was as ingenious as it was expensive, the metal curtain, which, during the day, could be lowered into the basement. As far as the conceptual idea and its tactical execution are concerned, there is barely anything comparable in the history of interior architecture. And this, you see, the black lines are the positions of these metal curtains. Its proportions alone lent this completely uninterrupted, smooth and shiny surface a special appearance. The visible surface of such a curtain is the area of the wall opening, which is 140 centimeters wide and 340 centimeters high. The metal curtain's inner side is all color and proportion, nothing else. Not a single screw or angle iron distracts from the tension between and width and height. It is an absolute abstract surface. The metal curtain certainly served to provide increased security, but more importantly, it functions as a substitute for the usual kind of curtains which Wittgenstein had forbidden his sister, so as not to distract from the clarity of his architectural language. When Mrs. Stoneborough retired to bed, the metal curtains was raised. Weightlessly, they floated upwards. This is how the housekeeper Heinrich Postel described the way in which the house was closed up at night. As I said, the metal curtain has neither bars, handles, or locking device. Wittgenstein had studied 2 years at the Technical University in Berlin. Employing technical expertise, logical thought, and a radical way of creating form, Wittgenstein here arrived at one of the most fascinating aesthetic forms in his architecture. This solution is technically succinct and convincing architectural form. However often one uses it, it remains sensually steering. A greenish-gray varnished color plane only becomes visible through the interplay between weight and weightlessness. Wittgenstein invents a pulley system which counterweight. A counterweight filled with small metal pieces fixed to the top of the counterweight allows fine, very precise adjustments of the weight. These exact adjustments ensures that metal curtain and counterweight are in a state of perfect balance. All one needs, right? All one needs for rising the heavy metal curtain, which has about 120 kilo, is a handle to set it in motion. If something is in a complete balance, you really don't need any extra energy to set it into motion. This handle consists of three elements. First, a 12 millimeter hole-like depression located 12 millimeters beneath the cover plate to the curtain that is set flush with the floor, as you can see it between the window and the grill. The second element is a 7 millimeter thick, 20 millimeter wide crossbar at the center of the heating grill, which is also flush with the floor and lies in front of the curtain cover plate. The third part of the handle is a rod designed by Wittgenstein with a hooked point. This rod, which is a lever arm, is inserted into the hollow, the crossbar functioning as fulcrum, and it's used to raise the metal curtain. By inserting the lever arm and exercising a minimum of force, the metal curtain floats weightlessly upwards. Wittgenstein's aesthetic of weightlessness is the result of combining his demand for exactitude and precision, which could only be achieved by working with metal, and his comprehension of the laws of mechanics. While Mies van der Rohe lowers vast glass surfaces, as in the Tugendhat House, by means of switches and electric motors, an abstract, non-sensual triggering of movement, Wittgenstein transforms the play of force between weight and weightless movement of the metal curtains into a gesture of sensual expression.